Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we have a really fascinating mission for you. This one, well, it cuts right to the core of a major religious history. We're embarking on an in-depth analysis of the credibility of the three principal witnesses to the Book of Mormon. You know who I'm talking about. Martin Harris, Oliver Cowdery, and David Whitmer. We've gathered their own statements, the contradictory interviews, the historical context, and we are going to look very closely at what the sources actually say, not just the traditional narrative.
And the stakes here, I mean, they just could not be higher. For the early movement, these three individuals were the absolute foundation. You have Joseph Smith claiming to translate ancient gold plates that, and this is crucial, no one else was allowed to see.
Right.
So the entire truth of that claim, the entire veracity of the Book of Mormon, it all hinged on the word of these three men. In fact, the Book of Mormon itself prophesied this very event four different times, most explicitly in Ether, where it states that three people would be shown the plates by the power of God.
To establish the truth.
To definitively establish the truth of the work.
And that context is so vital. For two centuries, the signed statement by these three men has been the church's historical, well, checkmate. The argument is pretty simple. They were all excommunicated, yet they never denied their testimony, so it must be true. Case closed. But what happens if we step back and look at the, hundreds of interviews they gave over their lifetimes?
Exactly. And what happens when we really analyze who these men were, the psychological world they lived in?
That's where it gets nuanced.
And you can track the lead up so clearly in the documents. The translation process gets going around early 1828. But the references within the scripture to these specific three witnesses, they start appearing in the parts translated in the spring of 1829. Joseph Smith also gets these targeted revelations, what we now know as Doctrine and Covenants, sections 5, 6, 14, and 17, detailing the role of the witnesses.
And these come out just before the event itself?
Just months, sometimes just weeks, before they claim to have the experience in June of 1829. The blueprint appears first, and then the event follows.
Okay. Let's unpack the famous how of it all according to Joseph Smith's own history. The three men, they go to Joseph and ask him to inquire if they can be the promised witnesses. So they go out to the woods to pray, but nothing's happening. The angel isn't showing up. And Martin Harris, he believes his own sinfulness is blocking the event, so he decides he has to step away.
Right, he removes himself from the group. And only then, with Martin gone, does the angel reportedly appear to Joseph, Oliver Cowdery, and David Whitmer.
So Joseph then goes and finds Martin.
Prays with him privately, and then Martin finally sees the angel in the plates, separate from the other two.
It almost reads like a historical moment where one participant had to, you know, leave the room before the magic trick could be properly executed for everyone else.
That's a good way to put it. And the identity of that remaining audience is very telling. If you exclude Martin Harris, who was mainly the financier, the other witnesses, Cowdery and Whitmer, they were already related to either the Smith or the Whitmer families.
So a very close circle.
A very close circle. But more critically, all three of them were deeply, deeply immersed in the 19th century magical worldview.
Okay, you have to tell us more about that because that really changes the context of what a vision even meant to them.
Well, back then, concepts like buried treasure guarded by spirits or using special instruments to find hidden objects, that was all very common. People believed it. These men were already practitioners. Oliver Cowdery, for instance, had a revelation from Joseph describing his gift of the sprout, which was just the term for a divining rod.
For finding water or treasure.
Exactly. So they weren't skeptics demanding empirical proof. They were, you could say, psychologically primed to accept a non-physical experience as totally real.
Hold on. So you're telling me the very individuals chosen to provide the singular physical proof for this massive religious claim were men who already believed in treasure hunting with divining rods?
It completely reframes the type of evidence they would accept, doesn't it? They were seekers of the supernatural, not skeptical empiricists.
And then there's Martin Harris. I mean, he is a story unto himself. The sources are just loaded with details about this man. He was the definition of a religious seeker. He jumped from the Quakers to the Methodists to the Universalists, always looking for the next thing.
He was a man of extreme belief, and it's documented in his own claims of these spectacular visions he had. We have his account of seeing Jesus Christ, who he described kind of oddly as the handsomest man. Then he also claimed to see the devil, calling him a very sleek-haired fellow with 4 feet in the head like a jackass.
A handsome Jesus and a donkey-headed devil. That's, well, that's a vivid imagination. But the accounts get even stranger.
They do. Harris claimed that he walked and talked with Jesus while Jesus was, and I'm quoting here, in the form of a deer. This isn't just seeing a vision. This is a claim of physical interaction with Jesus as a woodland creature. When you're looking at his credibility, you have to realize his baseline for reality was, let's just say, highly elastic.
And his personal life, the sources point to some really troubling things about his character. We're talking about a volatile temper and serious allegations of physically abusing his wife, Lucy.
With a bullwhip, leaving her black and blue.
Wow.
The documents do confirm that volatility, and his connection to the gold Bible business wasn't purely spiritual. Sources close to him, like his sister-in-law, they indicate he was really hoping for financial gain.
He thought he'd make a profit.
A handsome profit. And that motive helps explain his later behavior. He wasn't just a witness for Joseph Smith. He went on to become a witness for other self-proclaimed prophets who also claimed to have plates. James Strang, Gladden Bishop.
So we've got a man who sees Christ as a deer, allegedly abuses his wife, and signs onto multiple plate profits. Yet, his signature is held up as unassailable proof. Okay, let's talk about the actual document, the signed statement.
It's brief and it's collective. It just mentions the angel, the plates, and the engravings. But the logistics of how this thing was signed are often overlooked. We know from the printer's manuscript that every single signature is in Oliver Cowdery's handwriting.
Wait, say that again?
Every signature on that document is written by Oliver Cowdery.
Okay, so if the entire point of this was to provide physical, undeniable proof for a skeptical world,
right?
Why did they settle for a generic, undated, collective statement written by just one person? Why not individual, sworn, legally binding affidavits?
That is the central procedural flaw. A modern lawyer would have a field day with that. The evidence was homogenized, undated, and lacked any individual notarization. Now, they never denied agreeing with the statement's content, but the document itself is far from the gold standard it's often portrayed as.
And that sets the stage perfectly for the big problem that comes up when you ask them about the details years later. When you look across the 150-plus interviews they gave, the sources show these massive, undeniable contradictions about the setting, what they saw, and the very nature of the experience.
Let's start with the physical differences. Where and when did it happen? The official account says it happened in a piece of woods near the Smith home, with the three men together, more or less. But the early accounts immediately conflict with that. Oliver Cowdery in 1829 and David Whitmer in 1831, they both described seeing the plates in an open field.
An open field is very different from the woods. That's a pretty big inconsistency. But it gets worse, right?
It does. When it comes to Martin Harris, he later claimed his own personal viewing happened 3 days after the others. That completely contradicts the story that Joseph found him that same afternoon in the woods. So the timeline is also shaky.
And what they saw, that completely breaks down too. The official statement is so minimal. Angel, plates, engravings, that's it. But David Whitmer, in an 1878 interview, he suddenly lists all these other sacred items he saw.
Yes, much later in life, Whitmer claimed this whole collection of crucial artifacts were laid out on a table during the vision. He lists the brass plates, the plates of ether, the plates of secret combinations, the sword of Laban, the directors, the Liahona, and the interpreters.
Wait a second. If those artifacts, I mean, the sword of Laban, the Liahona, if those are absolutely core to the Book of Mormon, why are they totally absent from the original signed testimony? And why were the other two guys, Cowdery and Harris, silent about this whole table full of holy relics?
Exactly. That's not a minor detail. If they all saw the same physical event, the list of items should be unanimous. The fact that Whitmer adds these things later suggests either fabrication or, more likely, that the experience was fluid and visionary, allowing him to layer on details over time.
And that brings us to the most critical contradiction in all the sources, the difference between a physical versus a spiritual experience. We know that in maybe 95% of their interviews, the witnesses just affirmed their testimony. But what happens in that small percentage of interviews where someone really pressed them for the how?
That 5% is where the story completely changes. And it's where the sources strongly suggest the experience was purely visionary. They only clarified this spiritual nature when their credibility was directly challenged.
Let's get into those direct quotes because they're remarkable. Martin Harris, in multiple accounts, said he saw the plates only in vision or imagination. And most famously, he told the historian John A. Clark that when he was pressed about seeing them with his bodily eyes, he said, and I'm quoting, that he saw them with the eye of faith, though at the time they were covered with a cloth.
That one quote is just devastating to the argument of physical proof. Seeing something with the eye of faith while it's covered with a cloth is by definition not a physical confirmation. It's a subjective mental spiritual event.
It makes the entire purpose of the witnesses, to provide physical certainty, completely hollow. They were confirming the physical existence of an object that they themselves admitted they only saw in their minds, under a cover.
And David Whitmer backs this up. In 1880, he told a journalist the angel had no appearance or shape, and the whole thing was merely a feeling, an impression. Later, when he was under pressure, he issued a rebuttal to clarify, saying, "Of course we were in the spirit when we had the view, for no man can behold the face of an angel except in a spiritual view."
So the sources make it crystal clear. When pressed, they retreated to the defense that this was a spiritual, not a physical event. The angel had no shape, the plates were covered, the vision was seen with the eye of faith. It totally compromises the foundational claim.
It really does. The confirmation they provided was spiritual confirmation for people who already accepted spiritual things, not physical proof for the world.
And the credibility issues don't stop there. They extend to the fates of these men. All three were eventually driven out of the church. Oliver Cowdery was excommunicated officially for persecuting the brethren, but the real reason was his accusation that Joseph Smith was committing adultery with Fanny Alger.
An accusation the church has since acknowledged as true.
Martin Harris was excommunicated after he refused to go along with that disastrous, unchartered Kirtland Bank scheme, and David Whitmer was excommunicated in 1838.
And the church often leans heavily on David Whitmer because he affirmed his testimony right up until his deathbed. But while he never denied his testimony of the plates, he absolutely denied Joseph Smith's authority after he left.
He denied the prophet, but not the book.
Exactly. Whitmer publicly stated God's voice told him to leave. He published pamphlets saying Smith fabricated later revelations like the Melchizedek priesthood and the visitation of Peter, James, and John.
So this raises a fundamental question. Why would they never fully recant the original story, even after all that bitterness and excommunication?
The sources give us a few clues. First, their testimony had become their singular source of celebrity and legacy. They were famous because they were witnesses. And second, David Whitmer used his testimony to leverage credibility for his own religious offshoot, the Whitmerite Church. It was a tool for his own authority.
Okay, let's shift focus for a second. Even if we accept that they saw the plates in some kind of vision, does that validate Joseph Smith's translation?
Well, the source material makes it difficult to say yes. Joseph Smith's other translation attempts, they failed under scrutiny. The Kinderhook plates were proven to be a 19th century hoax, and the Egyptian papyri for the Book of Abraham were shown by linguists to just be common funerary texts.
Nothing to do with Abraham.
Nothing. So his ability to translate correctly was historically not validated. And as for the gold plates themselves, sources show they weren't physically impossible to make. A modern craftsman, using period tools, replicated a similar set of metal plates, weighing about 37 pounds in just 2 hours.
So let's wrap up with the key takeaways from this deep dive. First, the Book of Mormon is overwhelmingly a 19th century product. You can see it in the anachronisms like the Sermon on the Mount and the fact that it's had over 5,000 changes since 1830.
Second, Mark Twain had that very succinct critique. He called the book chloroform in print. He said whenever Joseph Smith's language started sounding too modern, he'd just throw in the phrase and it came to pass. Twain argued that if you took that one phrase out, the whole book would shrink down to a pamphlet.
Huh. And finally, based on those clarifying interviews, we learned that never denying the testimony, which was their lifelong claim to fame, is not the same as never denying that the angel and plates were physically there. They never recanted the impression, but they clarified it was a spiritual, subjective event.
This has been a really insightful deep dive. We've learned that the historical checkmate argument about the witnesses, well, it collapses. You've got the psychological context, the huge internal contradictions, and their own admissions that was a spiritual experience, not a physical one.
Which leaves a pretty important question for you to think about. If the core purpose of the three witnesses was to remove the need for faith by providing tangible physical proof, what does it mean that their own accounts, when you really examine them, rely entirely on a subjective spiritual vision seen with the eye of faith?
Does that fundamentally change the deal they made with history? And should belief in this foundational text rest on accounts that, under pressure from the witness's own words, really start to strain credulity? That's the exploration we leave you with.
We encourage you to use this information to inform your own exploration. Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive.